Welcome. You are about to participate in an exciting verse-by-verse Bible study. This program offers an exegetical, historical-grammatical approach to the Bible. Our host, pastor-teacher Bob Utley, tries to corroborate his teachings from five areas: word studies from the original languages, grammatical construction, context, parallel passages, or historical and cultural insights. This is one of the several series that Bob teaches weekly. Get your Bible, and let's begin our prayerful study of today's lesson.
Hello. We're going to be in Matthew 14 today. It deals with several different accounts, as again, Matthew is combining different incidents in the life of Jesus for theological purposes, usually following the chronology of Mark. But here in this example, it would be another instance where he did not exactly follow chronology, but inserts the death of John the Baptist. And that's really what verses 2 down through 12 is all about. Something about what happened earlier, okay? Let's notice it says, at this time, Herod the governor heard the report about Jesus. Now, it's funny he hadn't heard, but of course he was somewhat isolated with his luxury and all. And this is Herod the Tetrarch, which meant he was ruler over one-fourth of what his father, Herod the Great, had left. And so he had some ties with Rome, and he's one of the very important Herods in the New Testament. Now, there's several different Herods. It gets confusing. There's Herod the Great, who killed the children at Bethlehem, of course. This is the Herod Antipas, which is abbreviation for Herod Antipater, which is the one that's going to kill John the Baptist. And then later on, we're going to have Herod Agrippa, the first and second. Herod Agrippa the first is the one that's going to kill James the apostle, and Herod Agrippa the second is the one that Paul's are going to appear before in Acts. And there's all kinds of interrelation here. I think it's going to be interesting. You think Peyton places something, you haven't heard about the Herods, I want to tell you. So when he heard the reports about Jesus, now I really think that verse 1 links up with verse 13, when Jesus heard it. I don't think we're talking about the death of John the Baptist, but that Herod heard about him, was making some comments that he thought he was John the Baptist, revived. Because really, this death of John the Baptist happened much earlier in time than this account here in Jesus' ministry. So now here's the account of the death of John the Baptist. It begins then, and said to his attendants, the word here is boys. We have a couple of them mentioned here and there in the New Testament, particularly as one in Acts. This is John the Baptist. He has risen from the dead, and that is why the powers are at work through him. Now, the powers here are, of course, his word for the supernatural powers. Now, John never really did miraculous stories. Jesus is going to be, again, recorded two miraculous stories in this chapter, as there was in earlier chapters, to prove who he was. But Herod, I guess, thought that since he had come back, that the powers of God were involved in him. Now, verse 3. For Herod had arrested John and bound him and put him out of the way by putting him in prison. Now, the reason he had imprisoned him was because he condemned his marriage to his brother Philip's wife. Now, this is not the Philip who heads the territory in Palestine. This is the Philip that's back in Rome. And Herod had apparently gone to Rome to visit his brother. And had seen his brother's wife. Her name was Herodotus, and she is also a relative. She is the daughter of Aristobulus, who is also a full brother of Philip and Herod that we're talking about here. And she kind of lured, she apparently wanted to be the queen of something, and so she divorced her husband, and he divorced his wife. He was married to the daughter of the Arabian king of the Nabateans, and we have him mentioned, at least the Arabian Nabatean king in 2 Corinthians 11:32. It was really a mess. I'm telling you, it was unbelievable. Now, put him out of the way. This is in a prison. It's a fortress down on the eastern side of the Dead Sea. I believe it's called Machaerus, Machaerus. We found it this mentioned in chapter 4, verse 12, and chapter 11, verse 2. Just to plead Herodotus, his brother Philip's wife. Now, this, of course, is Herod Philip, and he is another tetrarch, which means ruler of a fourth. Let's see. For John had said, it's imperfect tense here, implies he said it over and over again, that it is not right for you to have her as a wife. Now, whether it's because she divorced her husband or because they were so closely married, she was Herod's niece. We're not sure. Although he wanted to have him killed, he was afraid of the people, for they regarded him as a prophet. Now, from verse 11, that almost seems as a different reason, but I think Herod Antipas had kind of one of these schizophrenic personalities of someone in power who tries to act real tough, but inside was very fearful and paranoid. Now, John the Baptist is the last of the Old Testament prophets. You might want to see chapter 11, verses 7 through 11, where Jesus said he's the greatest man ever born of woman. Oh, boy, that's what a tremendous affirmation Jesus gave to John the Baptist. But when Herod's birthday came, that could be Herod's anniversary for the date that he began to rule, but probably the word means birthday. Herodotus' daughter danced. Now, the tradition is her name is Salome. A lot of this we found out from Josephus. He's the one that tells us most of this. And you might want to see the Antiquities of the Jews, 18:5-4. You have three designations in Josephus to find a passage. The book, the chapter, and the verses. So you might want to read up on that, because that has much information about the Herod families. And it's very interesting to compare them with what here. Now, it says she danced. For a young royal, and she was a princess, to dance would have been seen as so lewd. Only low-caste prostitute types were dancing women in this day. For a princess to dance must have shocked all the crowd, including Herod. Now, there's been some discrepancy about how old she is. I imagine she's somewhere between 12 and 17, a very young girl, still manipulated by her mother. And, well, we see some real child abuse here, where this mother forces the daughter to do this lewd dance and then tells the daughter what she wants. My goodness. It's terrible. Later on, this girl's going to marry Herod, the not the Herod back in Rome, Herod Philip that was his mother's husband, but the other Herod Philip that's in Palestine. Then he's going to die very quick, and she's going to be a widow, and we know nothing else about her. We get that again from Antiquities, book 18, chapter 5. Now, that's what it mentions, and Herod was fascinated by her, so he passionately promised to give her anything she might ask for. Sounds kind of like Esther deal, doesn't it? And she, prompted by her mother, the word here is in Greek means to be put forward, thrust forward by her mother, shows their mother had planned this out. Give me John the Baptist's head right here on a platter. And the king was sorry. Now, why verse 9 and verse 5 seem to contradict is probably an ambiguity of Herod's heart. You know, he used to call for John and talk to him from time to time, seeing if John would change his mind. So I don't think he really wanted to kill him, but he was afraid of the man. But on account of his oath and his guest. Now, here's the two reasons. He doesn't mind committing premeditated murder for a capricious woman who's been scandalized with this prophet's preaching. But because of his oath and his guest, he's going to have this man killed. He brought his head on a platter and gave it to the girl, and the girl took it to her mother. Golly, that's a gross deal, isn't it? I wonder what a mother did. Some say that she did what an earlier person had done to one of the prophets who kind of got, one of the Greek wise men. She pulled his tongue out and stuck a hat pin in it. That's what Jerome says, but we have no idea where Jerome's got that tradition. Of course, Jerome living in the 4th century. And John's disciples came and carried off his corpse and buried him, and he went and reported it to Jesus. So they got a chance to bury his decapitated corpse, but his head, we don't know what Herodotus did with it. Now, notice what it says, and when Jesus heard it, and I think we're talking about verse 2, that Herod was talking about him, not this account of John's death, which is much, much earlier. He left there in a boat for a quiet place. Now, this is recorded in the other Synoptic Gospels and John. We find it in Mark 6, 32 through 44, Luke 9, 10 through 17, and John 6, 1 through 13. Jesus wanted to get away to pray. Apparently, he did that quite often in his ministry. The crowds were pushing on him. In this particular instance, he was afraid of Herod and Herod's wild actions. And so he just wanted to get away. So if you notice a picture of the Sea of Galilee, he would cross from Herod's Galilee, which was centered, his capital was centered in Tiberias at this point, and he would simply cross over to the other side, more of the Decapolis side, where Philip reigned, and he'd be more safe there. And when the crowds heard of it, they followed him on foot from the town. So when he got out of the boat, he saw a great crowd. His heart was moved with pity for them. Jesus says this several times. I'm so glad Jesus has a compassionate heart. He wasn't grumpy because he tried to get away and here these crowds are. I think there's something wrong with us and we get mad when our quiet time's invaded, you know. I've got to have my quiet time with the Lord. What are you doing messing with me? Well, Jesus didn't make it such legalistic. He saw this crowd. He wanted to get away to pray. He either wanted to get away to pray alone. He wanted to get out of that territory of Herod. Or he wanted to have more time to teach his disciples. And which ones, I'm not exactly sure was the motive. But anyway, this crowd foiled everything. But he had compassion on them. You will see Matthew 9:36 and Matthew 15:32. And he cured their sick people. Now, the implication is he has cured a lot of people. They brought them to him, and he cared for them. I think it's a sign of the new age. I think it's a sign of Jesus' heart. But it wasn't something he wanted to do for everybody. He didn't want to be known as a healer, a miracle worker. He had a message to give. But people were so hurting, and he took time to care. They were like sheep without a shepherd is what they were like. Now we'll see Mark 6, 3. Now, notice if you would, this deal about he cured sick people, he's going to cure them all over this gospel. Listen to this. Matthew 4:23, 8:16, 9:15, 14:14, 15:30, 19:2, 21:14. Jesus was moved with compassion when he saw the diseased of humanity. Oh my. It's a sign of the new age. It's going to be no tear, no more sorrow, no more pain. Former things are going to be gone. Praise be unto God. And the one who set up that kingdom is here with us. And when it was evening. Now, it's funny. If you look at verse 15, look down a little lower at verse 24, it seemed like there's two evenings. This is really just one full day in the life of Jesus, all that happens in the rest of this chapter. There's been some speculation that the Jews of Jesus' day talked about two evenings. One that began about 3 o'clock, called the early evening, and one that began after twilight. It seems that verse 15 is the early evening, about 3. And then the one down in verse 23 is the later evening, right after sunset. Notice if you would then what it mentions. And there is, and the disciples and him came to a destitute place. Now, not destitute in the sense of desert or something, but destitute in the sense of no large towns. Maybe a few little villages, but no large towns. And the day is over, and he sent the crowds off to the villages to buy themselves food. That's what the disciples are saying to Jesus. Jesus says, they do not have need to leave here. You give them something to eat yourselves. And the you is very emphatic here. He's saying, you do it. Oh, my. You don't see Mark 6:37. That's where the discussion of how much money it would take to feed all this crowd. The disciples are going, us feed them? What do you mean, us feed them? How are we supposed to feed this big group? You can almost see them croaking. They had forgot all the miracles that Jesus had done so far. And they said to him, we have nothing but 5 loaves and 2 fishes. Now, we learned from John 6:9, it's a little boy's lunch, right? It just shows in the hands of Jesus, whatever we have can be multiplied to fit the need. And he said, bring them here to me. And ordering the crowd to sit down on the grass. Now, we learned from Mark 6:39-40, they sat in groups of 50 and 100. What a beautiful scene, these white-robed men and women sitting on green grass on a hillside by a lake. Oh, it must be gorgeous. And he took the 5 loaves and 2 fish, and he looked up to heaven. Now, the normal way of Jewish prayer is the hands and eyes lifted to heaven like this. And it's just saying that. Quite often it says he lifted his hands or he lifted his eyes. It's the normal thanks he would give before a meal. He blessed them and broke them in pieces and gave the disciples, and they gave them to the people. And they all ate and had a plenty. And when they took up the pieces left over, there were 12 large baskets full. The people fed were about 5,000 men besides women and children. It's so far away from anywhere else. There probably wasn't a whole lot of women and children there, but there were some sick ones, I'm sure, that had come to be healed. So this is probably a 6,000, 7,000 healing. Now, what surprises me is this is exactly what Jesus was tempted to do by Satan in Matthew chapter 4, and that's win men's allegiance by feeding them. Matter of fact, they're going to try to take and make him king, we learn in John 6:15. I'm sure Jesus wanted to get away to pray about this. Here, what he said he wouldn't do, and that's feed people to win their allegiance, had happened in the midst of his compassion. And now I think they wanted to make him king, because make him a burger king, kind of, if you speak. And I think he wanted to get away and pray for that. So the next scene is going to deal with that. Before I leave, though, I want to mention here that I get so tickled. One of the commentators I read, who's kind of nervous about miracles, says that, well, what happened here wasn't really a miracle, but as the little boy shared his lunch, everybody shared their lunches, and that's how everybody got fed. Oh, yeah? Well, where did the 12 baskets full left over come from? This seems to allude to the fact that Jews carried their food with them because they were afraid if they got in a Gentile area, they couldn't buy food. It wouldn't be kosher. It's these baskets, maybe the kind they had in their belt, maybe one basket for each disciple. I was reading Broadus, who I like so much on Matthew. Best commentary available on Matthew is by Broadus. And he said, well, I hope they gave one basket to the boy that had the five loaves and fishes to start out with. Well, I do too. Now Jesus is going to walk on the water is the next account here. It's found in Mark 6, 45 through 51 and John 6, 15 through 21. Here's how it starts. And he at once had the disciples. This is a very strong Greek word. He forced them to get into the boat and go across the other side. Now, where on the other side, we're not know. There's some discrepancy here. John adds the word Bethsaida, and we're not sure where that is. There possibly are two of those. It's house of fish. And if there are, then it solves the problems. If they're not, there's a little confusion here. And all the Gospels are slightly different on some of their accounts. And he stayed to dismiss the crowd. Why? Dismiss them because he wasn't about to be king to give them food every day to heal all their sickness. He didn't come to do that. He came to preach the gospel and die in their place for sin. And so they're trying to get him off track as the devil had done earlier. And when he had dismissed the crowd, he went up on the hill alone, I'm sure to pray about all that had happened that day. He wanted to pray to start out with and got thwarted, and now he's there to pray. And apparently it took most of the night. And after the evening came, he was there alone. But the boat was already a long way from shore. How far, we don't know. Was it out in the middle? Well, one gospel seems to imply that, but probably it was fighting the wind along the shore and was being tossed by the waves, for the wind was against them. Now, Jesus knew that when he sent them on, I think. Just before day, this is the Williams translation of the fourth watch of the Roman night. Now, the Jews, from twilight till dawn, had three watches, and we see them in Judges 7:19 and Lamentations 2:19. But the Romans had four watches. The best place to see that probably is Mark 13:35. This is the fourth watch. So from around 3 a.m. in the morning till 6 a.m. in the morning was when Jesus came walking on the water. It was still very dark. That's why he must have looked rather spooky there to him. Notice how long he prayed. Oh, my. Boy, if Jesus prayed like this, don't you know we need this? God help us. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified. Now, you know, the waves were really blowing. The wind was coming strong. So the waves would reveal him, and then he'd go out of sight. Reveal him, and he'd go out of sight. Reveal him, and he'd go out of sight. And besides, it's kind of dark. It's just twilight, if anything. Well, they thought he was a ghost. It's the same phantom, same word used in Luke 24:37, the upper room. They thought he was a ghost. And they screamed with fright. Oh, my. Can't you see this scene? Then Jesus at once spoke to them, "Men, be of courage. It is I. Stop being afraid." And this "stop being afraid" is so characteristic of what Jesus says to his people. Listen to this. Same thing occurs in Matthew 17:7, Matthew 28:10, Luke 5:10, Luke 12:32, Mark 6:50, John 6:20. Do not be afraid. Ah, do not be afraid. Now, Mark tells he was just going to pass. He was going to walk by him, maybe encourage him, to show him that he was the power over natural elements. But they got so afraid that he had to get in the boat with them. I think I would too, to tell you the truth. Peter answered him, "Lord, if it is you, let me come to you on the water." Hey, Peter, this just sounds like him, doesn't it? Peter's my kind of guy. If you don't know what to say, stick both feet in your mouth. And so Jesus says, "All right, come on, come on." Peter got out in the boat and started walking on the water. Now, how far he walked, one step, I don't know, 10 feet, I don't know how far he walked. But, folks, he crashed. Began to sink. And he felt the wind. Now, it says he saw the wind. Well, that's tough. He saw what the wind was doing to the waves. He saw the boisterousness of the water around him. Took his eyes off Jesus and began to sink. And he cried out, "Lord, save me." Now, this is a good example of the word save in its Old Testament connotation of physical deliverance. I also want to say, isn't Peter, you know, the fact that he wanted to get out of the boat anyway in this kind of late at night with the storm going on, here's great faith, isn't it? Great faith. Wants to get out of the boat and walk to Jesus. I like that. Mixed with great doubt. I'm like that. Sometimes I feel like I have such faith, and sometimes I feel like I have such doubt. Boy, it's hard to know, isn't it? Jesus at once put his hand and caught hold of him and said to him, "Oh, you of little faith." As many times Jesus says, "Don't be afraid," he also says, "Oh, you of little faith." Listen to all this. Matthew 6:30, Matthew 8:26, Matthew 16:8, and this account right here. The disciples, he's building their faith little by little, but it takes a while. "Why did you waver so?" And they got into the boat, and the wind lulled. Oh, boy. He's been raising the dead. He's been killing diseases. He's been casting out demons. Now the wind and the sea obey him. Who is this? Who is this? And the men in the boat worshipped him and said, "You are certainly God's Son." Now, Jesus accepted this worship too, by the way. How much did they know by this? How much did they realize? I'm not sure. we're going to have the great confession in chapter 16. They knew something was here. Now, whether they knew it was full-blown deity incarnate, going to die on man's behalf, probably not. What does it mean, you are surely God's son? Well, there's no article here. This same thing occurs in Luke 27:54 about the centurion that says, surely this was a son of God. Now, most translations, mine says certainly it's God's son. Most translations say the son of God. I think what we have to say is we're not sure the theological level of their understanding. It's obvious that he had wowed them, and they're going to worship him. So it's obvious they recognize he's far more than just an average person. But they may have seen him still as just a prophet. And I say just in the sense, when you claim to be God incarnate, being called a prophet's not a real bargain. Now, many times throughout this gospel, the term God's Son has been used. Let me give you a few references. Matthew 16:16, Matthew 26:63, 27:40, 27:43, and 27:54. He doesn't use this term often because it's radically misunderstood by the Jews. He used the term Son of Man more often. But here they call him a Son of God, which had some implication going back to the Davidic king of 2 Samuel 7. Now, verses 34 down through the end of this chapter really are an introduction to chapter 10, which is going to be the mission of the 12. So whoever divided the Bible here, in my opinion, divided it in an inappropriate place. And, of course, you know that the chapter and verse divisions of the Bible are not in inspired order. Neither are the paragraph divisions. Neither are the punctuation. The ancient Greek text didn't have any of that. So I really think 34 should go the next chapter, but I'm going to cover it here. And they crossed over to the other side. Now, again, exactly when it says other side, that's pretty ambiguous. We're not exactly sure where they are, but they're probably trying to stay in the area that's controlled by Philip instead of the area that's controlled by Herod Antipas. And so what a cross means is uncertain. The men at that place recognized him and sent into all the countryside and brought to him all who were sick. See, the fame of him has spread, but the fame was of a healer, not of a teacher. And I say that, and maybe that's not true. It may be that they just knew that he was a teacher, but that he had compassion on common people. You know, the Jewish authorities of Jesus' day just didn't care about people much. These sick folks were excluded. Now, they might pray for him at a distance, but they didn't want them in worship service making them unclean. Just that some religious figure cared about them must have been such a beautiful attraction to them. They brought all the sick to them. Now, this must have been an area with a lot of Gentiles in it. A lot less kosher Jews than down in Judea. But Jesus makes no distinction, apparently, here. Whoever came to him, he healed. He didn't go out of his way to heal, but those who came, healed. By the way, I just want to say to you, I still believe in a God who heals. I don't know why when I pray for such great Christians, it doesn't always happen. Matter of fact, I obviously don't have the gift of healing because most of the time when I do pray, it doesn't happen. But folks, I believe the New Testament. I still believe in a God that heals, and I still pray for healing for those who ask me to. And I still believe God still does it. As there was an intensification of evil around the time of Jesus' first coming, as there will be around the time of Jesus' second coming, it's my personal opinion that there will be an increase in healing around the time of the second coming as there was around the time of the first. When the demonic makes an assault, God's grace makes even a more abundant assault. And this healing was, of course, a way to try to confirm the message, to show to people quickly that he really was a prophet of God. And they continued to beg him to let them touch just the tassel of his coat. And again, this is the prayer shawl, the tallith we talked about back in chapter 9, verse 20. Only Matthew, of course, writing to Jews. The other Gospels, like Mark writing to Romans and Luke writing to Gentiles and John writing late in the first century to Gentiles and Romans, don't mention this technical idea. But it was a shawl you put over your head as a sign of reverence to God. You know, and it's funny, today Catholic women wear some on their head, but then Jewish men wore something as a sign of God's presence in their life. So this chair shawl, whenever we pray, he would put it up over his head. And now it was just laying on his shoulders. And they just wanted to touch it. Now, there's some of the magical here, like the woman with the issue of blood who touched it back in John chapter 9. Whether they thought there was something magical in the prayer shawl or whatever, we're not sure. But now, what amazes me is Jesus worked even with their weak faith. And I'm so glad about that, because, you know, many times even the apostles said they didn't understand and they didn't know and they didn't recognize. Boy, I am so glad the apostles didn't know and recognize. I'm so glad these people had a mixture of superstition and magic in their faith. I'm afraid I have that, and I don't even want it, but I'm afraid I do. Sometimes I pray and pray and pray and don't understand Jesus. I'm so glad that He cares for me, even amidst of my not understanding, in the midst of my inappropriate theology. Jesus cares. He let them touch His tassel, and by George, they were healed. And all who barely touched it were completely cured. I've heard this chapter preached as one day in the life of the Savior. Oh my, what a day! What a long day! Notice the need for prayer. Notice the political sobby that says, this guy is going to be tough. I think I'll just leave his area. Now, Jesus could have struck Herod blind or wherever he wanted to, but he just left the area. Boy, there's some real contrast in this chapter, aren't there? From the sensualness of the Herods to the faith of the disciples that's not yet complete. They're still not sure whose this is it with them, but they're willing to fall down and worship Him. To these sick people, my goodness, coming to Jesus must have been going like to an outpatient clinic at a hospital. It was, you're afraid of the crowd. You'd know who you're sitting to. You're sick as a dog. And Jesus took care of it, folks. What compassion. That same one who had compassion then has compassion for you. I don't know what you're going through, Phil. I don't know what's happened to your life. But Jesus does. And He cares for you. Talk to Him about it. I've enjoyed being with you. I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.